Welcome to Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, a career consultant here in DCU. And today's topic is all about the early career as a second level teacher. Now, we're all very passionate about teaching. I think we're all very, very aware of the power of teachers in our lives that has shaped us and molded us as we go on in life. And I think everyone that's lived through COVID and maybe remote working definitely has seen the great advantage of the teachers and the role they play, not only in our own personal lives, but as a wider contribution to society. So joining me today to unpack the early career of a second level teacher is Sam Conroy. Now, Sam is the digital learning lead with DTL ETB. So first of all, welcome to the episode, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Siobhan, today. It's a great joy to be able to share some of my experiences with your listeners.
Brilliant. So one of the things that I suppose I might want to start off with is explain what DTL ETB is, and could you maybe broaden it out then to explain the whole patronage system for second level education here in Ireland?
Yeah, what a confusing sector the education system is. And as we just, you know, had a quick chat prior to this conversation, obviously all of the acronyms that are in use are really confusing for new teachers that are entering the system. So I suppose the one thing just to let people know, there are many different patrons in the Irish education system, and the education and training boards are just one of those patrons. There are 16 education training boards in Ireland, and they're located all around the island itself. And we're just one of the largest ones. We're based around Dublin County, and we stretch from Balbriggan right down as far as Loughlinstown. So we have a really big geographical reach. We currently support 10 community national schools, which are our primary schools. And we've over 30 second level schools, and we also support further education colleges as well within the sector. And what I love about the ETB system is that it's totally about lifelong learning. So in theory, you could be 4 or 5 years of age starting in one of our CNS schools, and you could be 95 years of age in one of our further education colleges or adult education services. So we really, really promote lifelong learning in education and training boards, which I just think is wonderful. So the thing I would just say to upcoming new teachers that are arriving into the education sector, just be fully aware of what your patronage stands for. What is their mission statement? What are their strategies? Be absolutely aware when you're applying for jobs who the patronage and where the school stands under that patronage umbrella. And it's just a really good idea to do a full investigation of, as in, you know, in terms of my moral compass as a teacher, what patron is going to suit me best.
Okay, so bringing you on to that, so you were able to very well explain, say, you know, your own local ETB area. But so you have the ETB, so who are the other patrons then? What's going on there?
Yes, you've got a real mix of patrons. I suppose one of the most famous ones at the moment around would obviously be Educate Together, which would be one of the other patrons. We'd also have a patronage for our Gael schools and our Gael Colossi. And we have also the Catholic patronage as well. So there's quite a number of these patrons around. And as I said, just as a teacher, you know, when you see an advertisement for a job, it's probably not the first thing that you look for in terms of, oh, who is this patron? But I would really strongly advise that it really sits well with you and who you are as a person when you're entering into a patronage. You know, like myself, when I started out, Siobhan, I had no idea who the ETB were. And in fact, they weren't the ETB when I started over 20 years ago. They were actually County Dublin VEC. So an entirely different system, which has now evolved into this ETB system. So just to be completely aware is really my top tip in terms of when you're looking at those jobs and those advertisements that are out there.
Okay, so we're going to move into that whole early career piece. And I think for any profession, and I'm very strong in this, no matter what career you pursue after college, or even if you don't go to college, it's irrelevant, but starting off in your career, the first 5 years in any job or any career, you know, they're tough, there's huge learning curves. So just even we have a look that, you know, you're a student, you just graduated, you're starting in your school in September, you know, maybe could you sketch out that first year in particular? Because I think that's a real steep learning curve.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being absolutely terrified. I think that would be one of the real key words I would use. You know, there's huge challenges, I think, when you enter a school. Oftentimes, you're entering a community with many of our schools have up to and over 1,000 learners in them. And many of those schools are going to have, you know, a staff of over 100 teachers. It's a very busy, you know, it's a chaotic environment at times. And it can be very, very challenging when you're the new person with the expectations of entering these staff rooms where there's so many layers of politics there already. Where do I fit? Whose cup do I use? Am I allowed to use the milk? You know, even just the basic questions of the social norms of a staff room are very challenging, never mind the challenges that you're going to face within your classroom, you know. And I think one of the probably the best things I would probably advise people to do, and I didn't do it myself, was just dive in. You know, there's no time for complacency in a school. You have to be brave. You have to make decisions quite quickly. You have to be involved with your staff. You have to get to know your learners. And I would say really just challenge yourself on every level. You know, if you've got a good idea, go tell the, you know, a member of the leadership team. If, you know, if you're struggling in an area, go find a mentor. Now, I know many of our brilliant mentor systems that are currently set up in our schools will allow for that to happen. But the expectation is people forget. You know, I'm 20 years from my start point, and I forget even how difficult it was. So I think even if you're assigned a mentor, it's really up to you to put the pressure on that person to help you. Reach out to them. Tell them when you're struggling. Keep a diary, maybe, you know, of those first couple of weeks, in terms of what is causing me anxiety, what can I solve for myself, or what do I need to reach out to somebody else to help solve? You know, these people have, I mean, there'll be hundreds of years of experience within a school staff. And I think it's don't be fearful, you know, really just dive in, you know, show innovation, and just be willing to take help from people.
And I suppose I always say to students as well, or grads, is don't forget to rely on what you've been taught on, you know, through your degree. And one of the strong core things around, you know, preparing to be a teacher is, you know, is really working on preparing for your class, you know, doing your lesson plans, you know, getting the evidence out for what you're going to do that will help you with your confidence as well. Because A, you are actually there to do a specific job. Okay, that's number one. And number two, you know, if you prepare as well as you can, it will give you that kind of level of confidence to walk in through the door.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great advice. And oftentimes, I think when people are in a, you know, a teaching practice mode, they often think, oh, it'll be so different when I start my career. And in fact, that's not the case, because many times you're going to be heaped with a full timetable, maybe of 22 hours. And, you know, I mean, the research has shown us that for every hour that of teaching that will take place in a classroom, you're probably looking if an hour, if not more, in terms of preparation. And that never gets easier. And I think that's something that people have to be very realistic of. And hence the reality of why we're only teaching 22 hours maximum. You know, now it's 21:40, obviously, with our 40 minutes in junior cycle. But just to be really, really cognizant of that, that is not going to change. The level of work is always going to be there. And I think, you know, you need to be realistic that you're probably going to clock up about 40 hours a week, you know, which is in the normal world is a standard working week, I suppose. So there's not really a case of, oh, I'm only, you know, I've only two classes today. I'll pop off to the shopping centre for the other, you know, 6 hours or whatever. It's really make the most of that time as well, I think, that you have in school. If you have free time, do your preparation. You know, try not to get too distracted with the coffee drinking and chats with colleagues. And really, you know, Siobhan, I think a top tip is the more prepared you are, the more classroom management will be easy for you. And I think the style of teaching and learning that really we're heading into now with our new curriculum focuses is really more about the teacher being the facilitator in the class. So learners are really trying to lead their learning. They're very much responsible for them being the focus of what's happening around learning in the classroom. So it's less focus on you as a teacher. So really, the more preparation you've done for that lesson, the easier that process will be in class. And I often laugh because people would, you know, when we talk about this type of role that teachers are now facing, this facilitation role, there's often a sense of, you know, oh, sure, they were doing nothing. They were just standing around the classroom looking at the kids doing the work. You know, when really people don't realise the amount of preparation that had to go in to make sure that group work happened effectively, to make sure that all of those outcomes were achieved, to make sure that you're communicating well with the learners. So all of that is kind of the hidden work that goes on behind the scenes. But really, if you can walk into a classroom and you can allow those learners to really lead that learning, you can be sure that you are preparing, that you're ready for those classes. And that those learners, they, you know, the kids are smart. They read between the lines. They know when a teacher is not prepared. They know when a teacher is prepared. And if you are not prepared, you will pay for that. I mean, that's kind of really the bottom line for it.
And just going on to the classroom management side of things now, I think anyone during the teacher education process, they'll have good days and they'll have bad days and things that went well and strategies that, you know, worked for them this time, didn't work another time, didn't work with one year group, it worked with another year group. But just when you're going into that more formalised, you know, you're, you know, you've got a contract of employment, you have a lot of responsibility and so on, you know, and I know you mentioned about the mentor, any kind of strategies around that classroom management piece. We've mentioned being preparation, and I absolutely believe it's 99% of it, but it's just to try and get that 1% sweet spot. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what I've always really considered, my background is that, you know, I was a music teacher in one of our schools for 16 years before I entered into this role. And really, I suppose one thing that I've always learned is stretch the learners. You know, if a child is bored, they're going to act out. I mean, wouldn't we all? You know, if you find yourself in a situation that's really, it's not, you know, it's not reaching you, it's not stretching your learning, you don't feel like you're enthused by the learning, of course you're going to act out. And then classroom management becomes an issue. So I totally believe if you stretch learners, you know, and really encourage them to think about their learning and very much deep thinking, I think then, you know, you'll avoid any of those type of classroom management issues that would occur. And really, you know, to me as well, the less talking you do within a classroom, the less classroom management issues you're going to have. So, you know, if you're looking at a classroom and you're thinking, well, I'm going to talk for 80% of the time, well, then obviously, you know, people are not going to sit there. What does research show us? I think for a maximum of, you know, 15 minutes for learners kind of in and around the age of 15 and 16. So you can assume that it's less for those even younger learners. So really, if you make that your baseline of, you know, I will instruct, I will give them the amount of instruction that they need to carry out the next task, but you're always on point of moving them to their own type of learning, moving them to their group, moving them to be able to do that independent piece that's going to keep them interested in what's happening in the class. I suppose the second one is, I would be saying you just have to have that respect with your learners and encourage them that they're reciprocating that respect to you as well. And I always think, you know, one of my things I always did was when I'm having a bad day, I tell my learners, I'm having a bad day. You know, I'm not on top of things today. You know, I feel a bit tired or I'm a bit sick or whatever the case is. And I've always found that they're happy to step up. They're happy to support you. So as much as you will do 90% of the supporting, when you are having those off days, share those experiences with them. You know, I mean, you're going to know these kids, many of my kids, because I was the only teacher in that department in the school. I would see them every day for 6 years. You know, and that's a huge relationship piece that you're doing there. So I'm a big believer in the holistic side of education, the holistic side of delivery, and really having that trust, having that respect, building those relationships, you know, is so important. And I truly believe, you know, education, the baseline is learning. That's what those kids are there to do. They're there to learn, but they will learn a lot more effectively if you have that relationship, holistic piece built with them.
And moving on to the more holistic piece there, you know, just around their own teacher well-being, you know, I think it's just very important for any of us, no matter what profession we're in, is to look after our own health and our well-being. But one thing I think everyone that works in any level of the education sector, whether it's primary, second or third level, is it's the energy required, it's quite an intense experience working with young people. And I even know that ourselves working at third level, you know, it's full throttle all day, every day. And they exude an amount of energy that as you progress as an adult, you need to keep racking up your game around your own energy to meet it. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose from my own experiences in the past, I would have come into quite a traditional form of education and, you know, learning delivery. And I often thought about there has to be better ways to do this. There has to be easier ways, because I totally agree with you, Siobhan. Like, you're full on. You are the entertainer at the top of class for 22 hours a week. And to be honest with you, 5 years into my career, I really, really wondered, could I sustain this level of energy? And it really took me to sit down and very much consider what I was doing and what I was contributing. And when I really examined what I was doing, I was creating too much content at home, spending too much time on that. I was then putting myself, you know, 100% on entertainer mode when I was in the classroom. And really for me, you know, I suppose it's what I was pre-junior cycle, I suppose, but it's really what the junior cycle is now promoting, that we're handing over that, you know, majority of the teacher-led stuff that's happening in class, we're handing it over to the learners, and we're trying to get them, I suppose, to guide their own learning, to lead their own learning. And technology is obviously a brilliant assistant with us in the classroom to do that. But it was very much me as the teacher having to sit down and really question, what is my role? What am I trying to do? And once I shifted from me being the focus of the learning in the classroom, and once I handed it over to them, I then found the amount of content I was producing was reduced. The amount of energy that I had to spend in the class was reduced. And really, it changed my entire mindset. But it did take me a number of years to do that. And I think probably easier for teachers now coming in, because as you said, they've had a lot of guidance in terms of their degree. And, you know, the curriculum focus is now so heavily laid on our learners with less on the teacher. I think really well-being is at the heart of everything that we're doing with the curriculum reform. Hopefully we'll see that in our Leaving Cert as well in the coming years. And I think that's going to shift how much energy, you know, how we take care of ourselves as a profession. I think there's a huge shift happening in schools at the moment, and I think there's a bit of a challenge for teachers. We probably have, you know, about a 70-30 percentage on it, where 30% of our teachers are really looking at this new focus in terms of what they're doing in class and how they're doing it. And then we maybe have a 70% of our teachers who are still struggling, and they're trying to do everything. They're still trying to do the teacher-led piece while they're trying to do the new focus of the learner-led piece together. And really, you have to just shift. One has to give. And that's the question that I think is going to be, you know, in many of our minds in the coming years. But I think welding is always going to be a struggle because, you know, it's a type of a profession. It is a vocation. And in these giving jobs, in these nurturing, caring jobs, people tend to give 100% of themselves. And, you know, teaching doesn't suit everybody. And that's another really important point. I think, you know, you have to realise if you're in a school, that school mightn't suit you. You know, a school is a family, it's a community. And if you feel you don't fit, there is a school that you will fit, you know. And I think it's always, don't be unhappy in your situation. I think that's a really important message as well. And really, again, when you're looking deep inside yourself, what is it you want? What is it you stand for? And, you know, once you find that out, you'll become, you know, an amazing teacher in terms of what you can bring to learners.
One of the areas that I feel particularly passionate about, and I think a lot of people do that's in the teaching profession, is the whole area of, I suppose, and I think it really has, a double effect, you know, around being involved in the extracurricular activities of the school and the life of the school. So, you know, you often see that teachers who do get involved in things very student related or maybe just related to the well-being of the staff, you know, kind of enhances their own well-being because there's parts of them being expressed, not suppressed, you know, by getting involved in the extracurricular. What's your own view on things like that?
Oh, Oh God, you're talking to the queen of the extracurricular Siobhan here. I mean, because I was the only music teacher, you can imagine the stresses and strains in terms of what the
choirs was it.
So, oh my goodness! And I used to joke, you know, there would be an opening of an envelope, and there'd have to be a choir or a band or an ensemble of some sort out for the event. I think I have to be really honest here. I've a huge change in mindset about this over the last couple of years. You know, we would have been a school that was very much involved. We would have had multiple ensembles on the go. We would have had the yearly musical happening, you know, and all of these things, I think, contribute very, very much to the point where I got to where I just thought, my God, I've really set, you know, I've set my cards out here. And there was no sense of, you know, this workload reducing over the years. If anything, it was increasing, and all down to my own doing, in fairness, you know. And while my leadership team was always very, very thankful for all of the work that I did, and while I was building all these amazing relationships with learners, I mean, I meet, you know, learners from, you know, 10, 15 years ago now in my local supermarket, and they're still over for the chat. And all of that relationship building was brilliant. But the thing I would really question while I was doing all of that, did my teaching and learning and the outcomes of my learning and the reason for my kids being in the school, which was ultimately learning, did that suffer in any way? And was I promoting a sense of a holistic education for these learners rather than maybe a classroom-based education? So while I do, you know, huge believer in the extracurricular and the holistic approach, it has to be in every school and it's the core of every school. We really, if we bring it back to baseline of an outcome for people coming in and walking into a school, it is to learn, and it is to learn from the curriculum. And I think if, as a teacher, you're not making those curriculum links with the extracurricular activities that are happening, then we're probably not delivering it on a par which is linked. And I think that's very important, because oftentimes I see, oh, you know, we go to play football for the football team. And while that's brilliant, oftentimes it's some of our most academically or our weakest students who are on these teams. And, you know, you can question, oh, it's brilliant, they're building the relationships with the team and all the team spirit and all of this. How is that linking with their learning? Now, I've no problem if you go and you join the football team and you miss, you know, two classes a week because you're off playing football, if that's going to be linked into the curriculum as a team building exercise or as a well-being exercise. So sometimes I think we need to be a bit smarter about how we're doing that whole school planning. How are we connecting everything that's happening in the school? And more importantly, how are we communicating these messages with the learners so that if a learner is going off to play football, they understand the rationale for it and they understand how that's linked with their learning. And maybe they're taking a bit of maths with them when they're doing that, or a bit of science. What direction is the ball travelling in? How far is that ball going to travel? So just to be a bit smarter, I think, about these things would be something that I, you know, have conversations with many leaders now. And I think people are starting to make those connections. So again, just back to the question, I suppose, while it's important, you know, if you're a teacher and you're thinking about the extracurricular piece, why are you doing it? And how are you going to make that happen?
So what I'm hearing from you is both at a whole school level, a department level within your school, and you as a teacher, you need to examine the whole extracurricular piece and see how it can be integrated and what needs to be prioritised and what plainly does not need to be a priority when for the department's planning or for the school planning. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah.
And the big thing as well is, and I think this is very, very important, and I think we all can appreciate whether it's a primary, second or third level, is not for any of us, is not to compartmentalise our learning. You know, it's not choir, but then choir is not music. If that makes sense, because some people are not making the association. Do you know what I mean? So it's just things like that. And it's trying to get a bit more of an integrated, holistic in the kind of getting all the brain firing on for the one time, not just now and then in different spots, and joining up the dots for both the teachers and the students, and obviously the leadership team and the school. I had to laugh at you about the musical, because I have to say it's one of my fondest memory, I said, of school was we did Finian's Rainbow in second year. Oh, and it was life enhancing. Do you know, we just not only had a ball, I have to admit we did really have a great time. But, you know, it did wonders for a lot of our a lot of our confidence at the time, you know, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, and we had our school reunion last year and we were saying, oh, do you remember when we did that? You know, it is a lifelong memory. So part of me is kind of saying, yeah, but please don't get rid of the musicals, whatever you do.
And look, I totally agree with you. And I have to say, I think we, you know, I think we did 12 musicals at 12 years in a row and we were all fit for exhaustion at that stage.
Yeah, it's changed it up a bit, I think. Yeah,
absolutely. And we got smarter with it. So we would always then start, we turned it into a transition year program.
Oh, great idea.
You know, we didn't allow our kids to go to class while that was happening. And there were people involved with the program designs and the costumes of the, you know. So I think we just started to think, how can we turn this around and make this into a learner-led activity rather than Sam, the music teacher, sitting at home, you know, having sleepless nights worrying about this and that and the other. So that really helped me, I think, in terms of get away from that compartmentalization. And also, I think, Siobhan, it's really important, like, just I don't want to focus on the school musical idea, but the school musical is often the biggest and the most costliest event that ever happens in a school. And it's the event that, you know, will involve the majority of the school community, in fact. So I think once we started to make teachers aware of that and to get other teachers involved, that really improved the well-being. So I totally agree with this idea of whole school activities and involvement in whole school activities that can really create a real shared sense of responsibility, a real community. And then obviously the stretches to bring in our parents as well, because I think that's the part that people are always afraid of, you know. Oh, you don't want the parents involved, you know, you want to keep them on the sideline, which is it's not, you know. You need a parental voice, you need them to understand the learning. I mean, look at the challenges we're now facing with our blended learning piece, where our parents just don't understand, because they all think of education as an education that happened in their time when they sat in rows in a classroom and it was teacher led.
Sure. Sure. Just bearing in mind, you know, we've talked about the early career development, and I suppose it's always to remember for graduates now or students that are planning their career ahead, you know, it's not always classroom bound. There's obviously the extracurricular, but there's loads of career progression in within the teaching system. And if you don't mind, Sam, how can you explain to me how you started off as a music teacher and you're now digital learning lead? Tell us more about your own career.
So I suppose I was one of those kids that I had the chalkboard and the whiteboard when I was like 7 years of age, and I was destined to be a teacher. And I see it all the time, even in my own kids. I have an 11-year-old who is just, you know, from the age of four, it was pretty obvious she's going to go into the teaching profession. And I think they're kind of, undeniable. They're just going to happen. So I ended up, that's where I went, and I went to Trinity and I did an undergrad as music education. So again, very much, you know, on that teaching path, so was involved in the teaching area for those 4 years of the degree. And then I went on and did a postgrad in music and media technologies way back. And in fairness, I suppose I was always interested in the technology part of it. And I mean, when I talk about technology, oh my God, Siobhan, we'd walk around with our projectors. I remember having a projector under my arm for the first couple of years in my school. When I would walk into class and I'd have the, you know, the projections on the board. So it was very kind of basic stuff that I would have been doing. But I was lucky enough to fall into a music job when I finished my postgrad in Firhouse Community College. In fact, it's one of the schools within DDL. And I stayed there for 16 years. And that's one of my biggest regrets. And I'm very open about it. And it's not that I, you know, came to dislike the school or nothing happened. You know, there was never a problem in the school with leadership. And I went through four leadership teams in my time there. And I suppose one of the things I would probably share with people now, I remember at one stage, one of my deputy principals said to me, Sam, never stay in a school for more than 10 years. And I kind of laughed and I said, you know what, I'm really happy here. I love all my staff. My staff, you know, the staff were my friends at this stage. We'd socialise together at the weekends and we'd go on holidays together. And suddenly around year 14, I just knew something was up and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I was quite stressed. And I suppose I started to really, you know, just consider where I was going. We'd had a freeze on any of the AP1 and AP2 posts at this stage. We hadn't had any interviews for about 10 years in the school. And it wasn't that I was looking for any type of promotion, but I just knew there was something not clicking for me at that point. And do you know what? It probably came in terms of the point I was unhappy was when I was in the staff room. And I don't know, still can't put my finger on that. I wasn't unhappy in the classroom. It was in the staff room I started to be unhappy. And I was unhappy with the negativity and maybe some of, you know, the negative, you know, chat about maybe some of our learners. And I just knew there was something up. So I stuck it out. And then an advertisement came in-house from our head office for this role as what was referred to then, I think, was a technology enhanced learning. And at that stage, I was using the little bit of technology in my own classroom, certainly wasn't a whiz, didn't even know the terms like virtual learning environment or cloud space or anything like that at this stage. So this role came up and it was a seconded role. And I said, you know what, that looks good, but I don't have the experience for it. And one of the things I suppose I had a fear of at this stage as well was I felt quite boxed in my career. You know, as a teacher, you sometimes think, God, this is all I can do. All I can do is walk into a classroom. And what other skills do I have? So I didn't apply for it. And my principal at the time, who was quite innovative, and he was only in the job about 2 years, and he came to me and he said, that role is made for you. And I said, sure, I've no experience, really. I have very little experience in technology. And he said, Sam, you'd be brilliant at it. So I applied for it and I didn't get it. And I remember getting a phone call from the CE to tell me I hadn't got it, but they weren't sure if the person that had got it was going to take it. So to hang in, so I was a bit insulted, obviously. And I got a call about 4 days later and he said, look, it's on offer to you. And I took it straight away. I haven't looked back. So the learning from it is, Siobhan, and this is the part I'd probably share with people. When something starts to feel wrong, just, you don't even need to know what it is, but just start to consider what's going to make it right. And the move was really frightening. And it was, I suppose, you know, you'd say, oh, well, you stayed within your ETB, Sam, so surely that was okay. I didn't know anybody when I moved out. But what this role has given me is, it's incredible. I now have an oversight of all of our schools, all of our colleges within the ETB. And I've an oversight to see what's happening in terms of what they're doing and how the learning is happening within the schools. I've gotten to know thousands of teachers. And really, I suppose the next step for me around, you know, where am I going next with my career? I've no idea, but I know I probably want to stay in this digital learning space. I think it's very exciting.
Brilliant. And thanks so much for sharing that. Just before we finish up, Sam, so our whole topic today was around being that early career as a teacher. You've shared some insights, some tips or whatever like that. But if we could kind of put you on the spot maybe for your top tip as you begin your career as a second level teacher, what would be that?
Find the right school. Definitely the first top tip I would give anybody. It might take a few goes. You know, and there's no failure in realizing that a school doesn't work for you, and that's okay. You know, there's such a variety of the schools out there, and familiarize yourself with the different types of schools. You know, they're very much dependent on the areas around where you're going to apply into a school. So, you know, I can talk about some of our schools within Dublin. You know, we've a variety of DESH schools, and obviously these are schools that would be in more challenging areas of Dublin. In terms of socioeconomic growth and, you know, availability. So generally, these schools can be challenging. There's issues around attendance, maybe parental involvement, and these kids would need quite a lot of support, but they can be very, very rewarding schools. So just to consider that when you are looking at schools, I suppose people are quite desperate to get jobs when you come out of college, and there's the expectation, you know, that you need to get a job immediately. And, you know, while this is important, I still wouldn't sacrifice my happiness. So even if you do take up a role and you find yourself in a school, you know, for a couple of months and you're not happy, then look for something else. On the other side of that, I think you do need to give yourself time and be kind to yourself. You know, schools are very challenging places. And it's interesting. It might be the first time that you're seeing it from the other side, you know, that from that teacher side, from that staff side, where you have those 22 hours, you're under a lot of pressure. And you're not going to settle in straight away, you know. So if you start somewhere, you know, late August, September, at least give yourself till Christmas or January just to find your feet. That first term is draining and it's really, really long, you know. So really give yourself the space in the October break to have a good rest and really, you know, try and just you settle in, you know. And probably the third tip I'd give people then is get out with your staff, get out and socialize. You know, you mightn't want to, you might feel uncomfortable, you might think that they're your colleagues and you don't want any extra friends, but it really is the only way to really, you know, get that support, get that time to have a chat with people. And the majority of teaching professions, they're professionals and they're really good at what they do and they've tons of experience to share with you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Pleasure, Siobhan.